Hey everybody, my name is Ryan. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is actually today, April the 28th, 2007. This is my home group, and I have a sponsor. There's been some other guys been able to work with as well. It's kind of an honor to celebrate here tonight. When Lindsay was talking, I was really happy she brought up her being the 15-minute speaker. That was actually my first time that I came to this group when it was at the old church. And the only thing I can say is I'm just really happy she's wearing a pantsuit tonight. Because the night she spoke, she was wearing a skirt that was about as long as this piece of paper, some street heels. So she's progressed a long way in the past 4 or 5 years. But the guy that I've asked to speak for me tonight, he's a good friend of mine. You know, we've been able to do a lot of things together over the past couple of years, and one of the big reasons why I wanted him to come speak for me tonight was maybe a month or 6 weeks ago or so, I asked him to come speak with me at a Friday night meeting, and he stood me up because he hates speaking. And so when I was going through my phone today, I came across, he didn't really stand me up, he couldn't go, he had something else to do, but he doesn't like speaking. And I came across his name, and I said, man, he hates speaking, and so I called him. And he was already downtown, he couldn't say no, so please help me welcome Stephen.
After? Okay. Hey, I'm Steven. I'm alcoholic. Sobriety date's January 23rd of 2006. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others, and this is my home group. Congratulations, Ryan, even though I wish your sobriety date was tomorrow. Lindsay, you did an awesome job. You did a really, really good job. I related to everything that you said. I'd like to say welcome to Vince and Crystal. Please don't let anything I say ever stop you from attending another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Seriously. This home group means a lot to me as well, you know, and a lot of you guys in here have played a huge part in my life, and you know, you guys have taken me to where I am today, I believe, you know. I'm just going to start and basically just tell you guys what it was like, what happened to me and what I'm like today. And from Paterson, New Jersey, from a pretty big family, and you know, even from the earliest age, my family life was, everything was good. You know, I have, both my parents are still together to this day. They love each other very much, and you know, they showed us tons of love, you know, and couldn't ask for anything else. And I have an older brother, two younger brothers, and a younger sister. And growing up, I really couldn't put the finger on, like, feeling different when I was younger. Lindsay hit it on the head for me, you know. I remember when I was younger that I always wanted to be somewhere else with someone else doing something else. You know, I never was okay with where I was at, you know. And I didn't know that was a form of being uncomfortable in your own skin. I learned that here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I always had to be moving, man. I was a shaker and mover, you know, even at a young age. And, you know, for me, we moved from New Jersey when I was around, I guess, 7, you know. I used to tell you guys 10. I come to find out I was 7. I was short for my age. And, you know, we moved down here. And I have a very big family. You know, there's probably at least 30 of us down here. And we all grew up, like, really close, aunts, uncles, cousins my age. And, you know, family was a very big part in our life. We always lived within, like, 5 miles of each other. So there was always some chaos going on, you know. It was always the parents calling each other to talk about how bad the kids are doing, and it was their kids' idea to do it and not their own. And, you know, and growing up my whole life, I remember my father, he played a huge role in my life. He was my father, you know, and he was someone that I looked up to, you know. I looked up to him a lot because he was epitome of what a man was supposed to be, you know. He provided for his family. He was a sole provider, and he was always home, and he was the coach at my baseball team, and he was just always there, you know. Great guy, someone that I strive to be like today. And you know, I looked up to him my whole life. And basically by the time I was I'd say 13 years old, you know, I kept getting in trouble in school. You know, I was the class clown, you know. I could never sit still for too long. I'd throw paper balls at the teacher and get in trouble and stuff. And my father was my coach my whole life, and he basically told me, you know, either Steven, you're going to straighten up, you know, or I'm going to stop being your coach. And, you know, he held up his end of the bargain, and I kept doing what I was doing, you know, and it wasn't long after that that he stopped being my coach, you know. And I don't know how most 13-year-olds handle things like that, you know. I don't know if a lot of 13-year-olds are sensitive, but I sure as hell was. And I took that personally as like my dad had like given up on me. And I remember around that time I just they call it ADD, you know, but I just couldn't pay attention to anything that was outside of myself was the deal. I couldn't, and I kept getting in trouble in school, and I get suspended off the bus, which was like pretty much getting suspended from school because my school was like an hour away, so it would like inconvenience my mom because she has little kids in the house. And basically, by the time I'm 13 years old, I remember I was hanging. Oh, well, the first time I drank, I didn't get drunk. I skipped school with a couple buddies, and it was monitored, so that's probably the reason I didn't get drunk. His older brother was there pouring the shots for us. And I remember I was drinking, and I hated it. It tastes gross. We were probably drinking, like, whiskey. I don't even remember what it was. And, you know, the one vivid memory that I had from that day was my friend, my best friend growing up. He got loaded, man. He was wasted. You know, he was probably 12 years old, not even 100 pounds soaking wet. And he was on his hands and knees pretending he was a lion, you know. And he was growling and chasing things around. And all I remember with thinking was like, man, you know, I want to feel like that. You know, like, I don't know why anybody would want to feel like that, you know, but I did. You know, I was like, that's where it's at, you know. So I remember the very next opportunity I had wasn't very long. A few months after that, we're all hanging out in the corner, and the corner in the suburbs. And we're drinking our quarts, and, you know, it didn't take much for me to get drunk. I remember I had two quarts of Budweiser's, and I was drunk, you know. And I knew I was drunk because before then I was a little shy with the ladies, a little introverted when it came to the girls. And, you know, I was yelling at girls that were driving by a mile away, you know, what's up, baby? You know, you need to get back here. And I loved it, you know. And I heard a speaker say once, like, the first time he drank it, he was completely okay with where he was at, where he was at, who he was, and who he was with, you know. And it was like the first time in my life that I felt any kind of you know, because I always had a busy head. My head was always going, you know, my head was always going about something. And you know, I remember the first time in my life that being okay, you know, that sense of ease and comfort which comes at taking a few drinks, you know. And you know, I chased it. I absolutely loved alcohol, you know, and I, more importantly, I loved what it did for me. And, you know, I like to say right off the rip, you know, my alcoholism stood in the way for me to being able to obtain any kind of normal life. By the time I was 13, I was already pretty bad in school, so you throw booze on top of that, you're going places in life, you know. And my family life became very strained, and this guy that I grew up looking up to my whole life, loving, I began to just disrespect any kind of rules that he had at his house, and disrespect him to his face. And at this time, they had two little babies in the house. They were still trying to raise. I was still a baby, you know, and they had other kids to raise, and I was just causing friction in my parents' home. And, you know, by the time I was 14, 15 years old, you know, I wasn't going to school anymore. After hearing Lindsay talk, I wish I would have moved to Tennessee, you know. I had a past, but we didn't know about that stuff, so I got a GED. Anyway, so I continued to drink 14, 15, and you hear a lot of people say our age, it's very hard for us to get our hands on booze at 14, 15-year-olds, especially when you look like me. You know, I was like 100 pounds. I was very short, very little. Probably looked like an 8-year-old, you know. What are you doing with that bottle, you know? Like, but... So we would steal it. Me and my cousin, we would steal it from our grandparents. I'd steal it from my father. I have an older brother. If I was nice to him, I'd try to get booze from him or steal his drugs or whatever, you know, whatever I could get my hands on. And, you know, by the time I was 16 years old, you know, I got in a hit-and-run car accident. You know, I overdosed a few times. And by this time, my parents, they don't know what to do with me, you know. I would just come home in blackouts, and I would say some pretty rotten things to my family. And at this time, you know, there's little ones there being witness to what's going on in my parents' home. And they didn't know what to do with me. They had no idea what to do. My mom had a brother who died from this illness when he was only 21 years old. And, you know, she tried to do everything she could to help him, and she couldn't, you know. And they didn't know what to do, you know. So they caught wind of this thing called Baker Act. And every time I'd come home wasted, they'd call the cops and be like, oh, he wants to kill himself, you know. And I'd go away for a few days because I was belligerent, you know. I was like, ah, I'll kill you, you know. And they're like, we got to get this guy in here. And every time I go in there, you know, I was like, I'm not trying to kill myself. You guys are ridiculous. Like, so what? I took 22 Xanax. Doesn't everybody? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't see what the big deal was. I didn't know that I suffered from an illness, like, that had a phenomenon. Like, once I started, my plan wasn't just to go out and get wasted to the point where I almost die. I just couldn't stop. I would just continue to go. And by the time I was 16, continued bad things. I got Baker acted probably like 8 times that year. And 17-year-old, and, you know, it's just, when I look back at what I did to my family, it hurts me a lot, you know. And the people that I hurt the most are the people that share my last name. And I will try my best not to do that anymore. And, basically, when I was 17, I mean, I was getting loaded on a daily basis. I was a high school dropout. I didn't work a day in my life. And when you're living like that and you have to stay loaded like I have to stay loaded, then you end up doing some things that you probably shouldn't do, or you're going to get in trouble for doing, you know. And I got arrested for the first time when I was 17 years old, and I was charged as an adult. And I remember my parents came to court that day, and my mom sitting there, and I'm shackled to, like, 10 other people, and I came from a good family, you know, and my parents loved me a lot, and I was 17, I was a little baby to my mom, and she's looking at me shackled to 10 other people, listening to a judge sentence her son away to a year, and there was nothing that they could do about it. And I remember when I walked back into that cell block that day, and I was getting ready to go and do my year, the only thing I thought about was myself. The only thing I thought about was my comfort. When am I going to get out of here? Why do I have to go away, you know? And that seems to be the thing that I suffer from the most, is that I think about myself too much, you know? And by the time I went away the first time, you know, my parents told my little brothers I went to college. They didn't know any different. They were babies. And basically the whole time I went away, I was an alcoholic, you know? I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I don't think very many people do know what an alcoholic is when they get here. I sure as hell didn't. And as soon as I got out, you know, I started getting loaded again, and getting loaded with my buddies, getting wasted. And it wasn't long after that, you know, I hit the ground hard. My parents, they let me come back to their house, and they gave me every opportunity I needed to get ahead in life. You know, all I had to do was be a responsible person, and I couldn't, you know. I couldn't do dishes, I couldn't cut the lawn, you know, I couldn't watch my little brothers. Hell, they didn't trust me to, you know. I would go in their dresser drawers and steal from them. And this all happened after I went away for a year. And basically I ended up leaving. They moved to Spring Hill when I got arrested, because the order I got arrested in, they were kind of ashamed, and they moved to Spring Hill, and I moved back down to Tampa, you know, and I started couch surfing. And still, you know, I never worked a day in my life prior to coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, so needless to say, I was a hoodlum. I did a lot of bad things for cash, you know, and I did a lot of rotten things to people that didn't deserve it, and I lived like that for about another year. And I remember at this time, my little brothers, they're getting a little bit bigger, and they're kind of knowing. I'm never around, you know. I haven't been around their whole life. And even when I'm not locked up, I'm not around. And, you know, basically, I ended up getting arrested again about a year and a half after I got out. And, you know, a year and a half after I got out, and I thought I would never get in trouble again. But this time I got arrested, and long story short, I'm sitting in the courtroom with this guy that I hated with all my guts. You know, I hated my father because he was a responsible person. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have been able to make a court at all. He made sure that his irresponsible, worthless son got up every day and got dressed and went to court. And I was sitting there next to him in the courtroom, and our lawyer came up to us at that time. He was like, "We got some great news for you, Mr. Holloman. We're going to go ahead and get you 4 years probation," you know. And that was great news. You know, that meant I got to go home and get loaded that day. You know, some people get excited about a relationship, maybe a car or a house. I get excited about 4 years probation, you know. And that's just how I was living. Because all that meant to me was I get to go home right now. I get to go home. And I never forget the look on my father's face while he was sitting next to me, shaking his head, saying, "You can't do it, man." And I was like, "What are you talking about? What would make you say that?" You know, like, obviously. But I was like, "I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you, Dad. You know, I'm going to go to school and get my GED. You know, I'm going to go and get a job. I'm going to go and get my own apartment." You know, because I always thought that I didn't know what the hell I thought. You know, for some reason, I always thought that normal living was a solution to my problem, when it's the furthest thing away from that. You know, I wouldn't know normal if it bit me in the backside. You know, I don't know about that stuff. You know, but it always looked like outside things would fix what was wrong with me on the inside. You know, and I didn't know that when I got here that I suffer from a spiritual illness in which only spiritual experience will conquer. I didn't know those things, and he was right. I couldn't do it. And, you know, 4 months later, I was in my parents' bathroom, and I was getting loaded on the way to go see my probation officer. And she told me that she was going to be dropping UAs. They gave me 4 months to make sure everything was out of my system. And I'll never forget, I was 20 years old, and I was sitting in my parents' bathroom getting wasted, thinking, what can they possibly do to me to make my life any worse? What can they possibly do to me to make anything any worse right now? So they sent me to prison. They made it worse. And, you know, I got sentenced to prison that day. And I'll never forget, I called my parents' house because it was their fault I was going to prison. You know, they didn't get a good enough lawyer. So, and I really thought these things. You know, we're crazy. I'm delusional, crazy. And I remember I called him. My little brother picked up the phone, and he was probably about 11 years old at the time. And, you know, the first thing he asked me was, would I be there for his birthday this year, you know? And my response to him obviously was no. And I asked him if he knew where I was going, and he said, yes, you're going to prison. And then I asked him if he knew why. And the best answer an 11-year-old kid could give me at the time was, because you drink too much, you know? And everybody always knows but us, you know? And you know, that hurt me a lot when he said that to me, you know, because there was times that I had good intentions in my life. You know, I was always full of good intentions, but never no action to back it up, you know. And, you know, I so badly wanted to be a good big brother. I did. You know, I wanted to take my brother to the park and throw the baseball with him, or take him to a movie, or I just wanted to be a good big brother. And for some reason, I mean, I was not a nice person, you know. For some reason, he saw something in me that made him want to be my brother, you know, that made him want to be close to me. And, you know, that whole time when I went to prison, I told myself that that I wasn't going to drink anymore, that I wasn't going to do these things anymore. Mom, I'm not going to hurt you no more. Mom, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to grow up. I'm going to become a man. I'm going to do what men are supposed to do. And I would like to tell you guys I did, but I didn't. I suffer from an illness called alcoholism, and I drank 12 hours after I got out of prison. You know, it talks about it in our big book that we have built-in forgetters, that we forget about the pain and suffering of a week or even a month ago, even 12 hours ago in my case. You know, those strange mental blank spots. I was without defense, like Lindsay said, no defense against the drink. As soon as I got off, I felt out of place in this world that I felt like I didn't belong in, and all I needed was a drink to make it okay. And basically when I got out of prison, my parents, again, they gave me every opportunity I would need to get ahead in life. And I threw it in their face, you know, and I continued to rob and steal from them. And I would bring things in their house that my little brothers could put in their mouth and die from without any regard for anybody else. You know, I was always just thinking about Steven. What about Steven? And basically what happened to me was, you know, my father had enough. You know, and he kicked me out of their home, and I became homeless at 22 years old without anywhere to go. You know, I had nowhere to go. I burnt bridges with everybody that knew me, you know, because if I knew you, I robbed and stole from you and lied to you and used you up. That's just what I did. And no one wanted me around anymore. And at this time, I used to have to call my mom and I probably weighed 138 pounds, you know, my face sunk in, yellow, and my mom would come and she would meet me on the corner and bring sandwiches for me just to make sure I was eating, you know, and I look back at stuff like that today, and I think of how strong of a woman she is for being able to do stuff like that. It's hard for me to do stuff like that for people. It's just hard for me to do anything for someone, you know, and that was killing her. That was killing her, and she just wanted me to be okay. She just wanted me to be okay, you know, and I called my mom, you know. What do all tough guys do when they run out of options? They call mom, you know, and I called mom, and I told her, I don't know what to do. I don't want to live like this no more. And, you know, I guess she's been waiting to hear that for a long time, because she got on the phone and she got me in somewhere real quick, real quick. It was like she called me back 20 minutes later, like, you're going here then. I'm like, all right, I don't know if I want to go anymore. You know, it ain't that bad. And, you know, that was January 23rd of 2006. And I had no idea what my problem was, what my solution would be, or the great life that I would have today if I followed you guys. And, you know, like Lindsay said, there were people there that were living big books in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they stuck their hand out to me, you know, because I was a floor guy. You know, I couldn't look at people in the face. I couldn't talk to people. Current events, I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, I couldn't have a conversation. You know, I would look for exits in the room. I didn't know what to do, you know, and, these guys stuck their hand out, and they pulled me into the middle of them, and they showed me what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And for a guy like me, that's priceless. I wouldn't be here today if someone wouldn't stuck their hand out to me, and I'm sure none of you guys would be either. And, you know, they made it a point to pick me up every single day to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I'm talking about these guys had their own family. They had their own wives. They had their own kids. You know, they had their own jobs. And they did what they were taught to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they came and they got me, and they brought me to you guys. And, you know, first step was very easy for me. You know, my life was a wasteland when I got here. There was not one area in my life that I could look at and was like, yeah, that's going pretty good over there. I could leave that alone. There was nothing good. I was destroyed, and I think my sponsor was glad about that. You know, there was not a lot of stuff in the way. It was not a lot of debating going on. Like, oh, should I do that? It was like, all right. You know, I didn't know what else to do. That's like my link to the human race right there. I got to do what he says. And basically for me, it's been an awesome ride, and you guys have been a huge part in it. And I would like to share with you guys that my sobriety has been awesome, you know, and I have a completely different life than I used to have, and it's all thanks to you guys, my sponsor, and the loving God that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this past weekend, I got to marry the woman of my dreams. And for a guy like me, you know, a one-week relationship is a big deal, you know, so I'm doing good. So, and it's from the principles that I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It's from what I learned here I try to bring into my relationship. And what I find is the more I try to practice those principles in my everyday life, the better person I become at work, in my relationship, with the guys I sponsor, with, I don't know about my sponsor, you don't get that part, but everyone else seems to get it. And I got to marry the woman of my dreams, you know, and I never would have thought that in my life that I would be able to experience something like that. And I got to experience it with a lot of close people, you know, and my mother, I ripped her heart out, man. You know, I killed her. I killed her. I got to share my first dance with her this past weekend, and we cried together this time. And it was tears of joy, you know. She was happy to see that her son grew up. And it's all thanks to you guys and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that I got to experience something like that. Because I'll tell you, I'm just a loser by trade, you know. I just take by trade. And I learned how to grow up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks for letting me share.
Hi, I'm Nikki. I'm an alcoholic. And this is Dr. Bob's last message, delivered at the First International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vasty of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed for 5 of the last 7 months and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.